This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Brian Geller, Executive Director of the Seattle 2030 District, a high-performance building district in downtown Seattle that aims to dramatically reduce environmental impacts of building construction and operations. Brian Geller is here today to give us an update on the progress made since the Seattle 2030 District was formed in 2011. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you so much for having me back on your show.
Would you remind us, why was the Seattle 2030 District started?
Sure. So I started the Seattle 2030 District at the end of 2009 as a voluntary committee. I was a sustainability specialist at ZGF Architects, a large architecture firm here in Seattle. And so because of my position, I got to see a lot of great work that was going on in downtown Seattle that was largely disconnected. So I saw this concept of a 2030 district as an opportunity to bring together a lot of great efforts, a lot of great companies that would, if they worked together around one set of performance goals, they would get a lot farther together than they would on their own.
How large an environmental impact does building construction and operations have?
It's very large. In the United States, generally speaking, building operation and construction consumes approximately half of all energy and is responsible for approximately half of all of our carbon emissions.
And why is the number 2030 in your name?
So 2030 comes from something called the 2030 Challenge. An architect, prominent architect named Ed Masria, put out in 2005 something called the 2030 Challenge as a challenge for the architecture and building industry, basically saying, if we're serious about climate change and energy independence and tackling these issues, we need to be building new buildings that are carbon neutral by the year 2030. And then just before we formed, he expanded that challenge to include energy, water, and transportation goals and less aggressive goals for existing buildings, which is the primary focus of our organization.
Why have you chosen to focus more on existing buildings?
We only replace approximately 1% of our building stock per year nationwide, and that's even less once you get into downtown city cores where you have historic buildings and buildings that are very large that have longer life expectancies than normal. It's even lower. So essentially, if we're looking at a 15-year time horizon, let's say, to really make an impact on climate change, the existing buildings is really where the battle's going to be fought and won, partly because there's just so many of them and most of them are still going to be here in 2030, and partly because the new building design and construction practices have actually really come a long way. And so the new buildings that we see coming up really have made great strides in the environmental impact arena. So that existing building arena is really where we need to make our progress.
What are the goals of the Seattle 2030 District? Would you elaborate?
Sure. So what we're trying to do is to achieve 50% reductions in energy use, water use, and transportation emissions in existing buildings by the year 2030. And we're trying to build carbon neutral new buildings by the year 2030, starting from a 60% reduction from average baselines today.
What are the advantages of focusing at the district level rather than at the level of individual buildings? Would you say more about that?
Yes. There are some opportunities that we're starting to ferret out around sharing of resources, sharing of energy, sharing of water that are just now starting to make themselves apparent. But even more broadly than that, just from an organizational perspective, it's very helpful to have the professionals who are operating these buildings, who are designing them. It's very helpful for them to have a forum and an organization where they can share their best practices and lessons learned, because I know people probably imagine these folks getting together to talk about this all the time, but they often don't. People are very busy in their daily lives. So having an organization that has a broad focus around these performance goals over the entire downtown rather than just building by building really lets us highlight buildings that are already very high performers. It lets us take that information and bring it to lower performers and create a real community effort where otherwise a lot of those buildings, both the high performers and the low performers, would tend to get lost if you're just looking building by building.
What is the current boundary of Seattle's 2030 district?
So essentially, it is what we call the downtown center city neighborhoods. We're really focusing on five of those neighborhoods, which are the Denny Triangle, Retail Core, West Edge, First Hill, and Capitol Hill. And so it's got a bit of an irregular shape if you look at it on a map. But it's basically what you would think of as downtown, plus South Lake Union. I forgot South Lake Union. and First Hill, where the hospitals are. We have expanded into Capitol Hill, but we do have a mechanism where buildings that are outside of those neighborhoods but are within what we call the center city, so if they're in the north end of Capitol Hill or if they're in the International District or in Belltown, they can still join and they have access to all of our services and benefits. We simply track them as a separate group just for our own internal data gathering.
Who currently belongs to the 2030 district? Who are your members?
We have nearly 110 members, so it's a large group at this point. We've got about 50 property owners and managers, some of the largest property owners and managers in the city, a pretty diverse group, a lot of commercial office buildings like Unico, CB Richard Ellis, Vulcan. We have a lot of institutions like the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center and Virginia Mason, and then Seattle and King County, and then a number of affordable housing organizations like Capitol Hill Housing, Bellwether Housing, and then a smattering of smaller individual building owners, which is always nice to see.
And what are the requirements for membership?
For membership, for a building owner or manager, when they join, they are required to share their data with us, share their energy use, water use, and transportation data. If they don't have it, we can help them get it. So share their best practices and lessons learned and challenges that they run into, and to use our targets as a guide for future planning. It doesn't mean that they're specifically promising that they're going to meet our targets, because we do have incremental targets every 5 years that you can see on our website, and they are fairly specific, but those are targets for the entire district in aggregate. We understand that buildings don't always take such a linear path. You know, sometimes they make big leaps when they do a major retrofit. Sometimes it's a challenge for them to reach these goals, but basically, through participating the way I described, sharing their data, sharing their challenges, learning from one another, we think that we'll be able to bring the whole group along much farther than they would get on their own.
What most motivates people to join?
So it varies. For the high-performing buildings, we have a number of buildings that have actually met our year 2030 goals. We've got some really great existing buildings in the district. They want to join to showcase the great work that they've done. A lot of them want to gain benefits in the marketplace by talking about the great work that they've done. A lot of them are simply very proud of the work that they've done. And part of the reason that they've done so much good work in the environmental arena really is to try to move the market. So they like being in the group because we can share a lot of their success stories. And then a lot of the lower performers, frankly, just use us as a resource, which is great, which is why we're there. They don't know where to find information on what are the latest incentives from the local utilities, you know, what sort of options are there for making improvements in buildings. It really would be someone's full-time job to know all of what's available in the marketplace. And so for a lot of organizations, they simply don't have the resources to staff someone to do that full-time, so they can use us, since it is our full-time job to know those things.
How do you go about getting new members?
So in the beginning, it was a lot of one-on-one meetings describing what we wanted to do with the group and trying to get their buy-in and their trust to join. I feel like it's been a lot of word of mouth since then. We certainly do target some large members that we want to have in the district for various reasons, but it's really a lot of word of mouth, members recommending one another. We also, I do want to mention that we have three membership areas, not just buildings. Obviously, the buildings are the focus of the group, but we have professional stakeholders who are architects and engineers and people who provide services in the buildings arena. And then we have community stakeholders like other nonprofits, the Cascadia Green Building Council, the City of Seattle, King County, who are kind of building owner and community stakeholder members. And they really support the building owners in this effort. So when they join, they donate some amount of their time, their services. It might be a service specific to what they do, or it might be just more general time and service on a committee. But they are really the backbone of trying to support these property owners in reaching their goals, because we have a very small staff still. Last time I was on the show, it was pretty much just me and then a couple of people at the city that were staffed at various levels here. We now have a staff of four, which is wonderful, but a lot of the work that we do depends on donated time, on committee work, and time from our professional and community stakeholders.
For building owners that decide not to join, what are their reasons?
We haven't had very many that don't want to join. Their reasons are generally concerns about privacy, because we do ask they share their data with our organization. We don't share their data publicly, so it is safe with us, but there are a few organizations that are very, very guarded about their data, and we respect that position. And also concern about meeting the goals. The organizations, when they join our group, they do take the pledge that they're making seriously, even though they're not saying their building is, again, going to meet the exact goals that we've set, but they are saying that they're going to support the goals that we have, use them as a guide, and really try to move the whole organization in that direction. And if they feel for various reasons like they're not in a place to do that, for it might be staffing, it might be because a building is about to be sold, they might be hesitant to join. And again, we fully understand if that's their situation.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Brian Geller, Executive Director of the Seattle 2030 District, a high-performance building district in downtown Seattle that aims to dramatically reduce environmental impacts of facility construction and operations. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What progress have you made since you started toward the goals?
It's been a challenge really measuring our progress toward these goals because of the time that we started. So we started in 2010, and when we show what the buildings have done over the last 4 years since then, it looks like they actually had a pretty good increase in energy use for 2010 to 2011, but then have been steadily dropping since then. And the reason for that is simply the economy. In 2010, buildings were far less densely occupied than they are right now. And so the reason we try to stick to our performance against these national baselines, or the national baseline for energy and then local ones for water and transportation, is because starting from the time that we put the group together, there simply are a lot more people in the buildings. They're used much more intensely. And we don't want that to reflect negatively on their performance, because having more people in the same building, having more activities in the same building, is a good thing. We want that extra density. But we have seen a steady reduction of 1 to 2% per year since then, for a variety of reasons, hopefully including some of the programs that we've been able to bring into the group.
And could you give us the actual numbers in the different categories in terms of progress made toward, for example, your first goal? You have goals at various time periods. For example, 2015, how far toward that goal?
2015, in terms of our group and the goal we've set for energy, we are already past that goal, because the goal for 2015 is a 10% reduction from the national average for building energy use, and we are at approximately a 19% reduction right now with the buildings that we're measuring. So we're very happy about that. That really speaks to not just our own group, but to the progress that has been made in Seattle over the years through really good conservation programs with Seattle City Light, excellent building codes that have been very well thought out and enforced. And so that's part of the reason we've seen that. For water and for transportation, those numbers, I would prefer people check the latest ones on the web, simply because we keep adding buildings in those categories. We don't have the same amount of data as we do for energy, so they do move around quite a bit depending on when we add new buildings into those databases.
Well, you mentioned some of the ways that energy use has been addressed. How about in the area of water? What kind of steps have been taken to reduce water use in your buildings?
So a number of our building owners have replaced fixtures over the last few years, their bathroom fixtures. Some have been piloting some innovative technologies with cooling towers, because some buildings in the city use something called water-based cooling. So they use a lot of water up on the roof to actually cool the air for air conditioning. And there's been a couple of building owners that have been piloting new technologies there that can dramatically reduce how much water they need to run through that system. But one thing I do want to mention in water is that we have, you know, I mentioned our three goals: energy, water, transportation, emission reductions. We did vote last fall to include stormwater management in our water goal, because we kept hearing over and over again from a large number of people in the group that they're very supportive of water conservation. But in terms of the big water issues for our region, polluted runoff going into the Puget Sound really is the biggest water challenge we have. Untreated rainwater runoff and combined sewage overflows is actually the single largest source of pollution for Puget Sound and Elliott Bay. And so our group voted last fall to really take this on and look at it the same way district-wide. And so we have a new tool for evaluating stormwater management measures that's on our website. It's Excel-based. It's very user-friendly, but it is very detailed, so building owners can run through it, add in all the things that they've already done, and evaluate if they wanted to put in a rainwater catchment system or a green roof or some trees, how big they're going to be and what impact they would have on the building. And that tool actually shows together the stormwater management and the potable water use of the building, what the overall impact is. So we're really ramping up the use of that tool right now. We just unveiled it a few months ago, so we're hoping to bring the level of activity in the water and transportation arenas up to the level that we've had for energy.
Would you say more about the transportation reductions? What are you actually measuring and what's happened there?
Sure. So currently what we measure are commute trips, because it's the only thing that we have really good, complete data for. So we measure how people get to work every day in the district. And we split it up into people that drive alone, people that take mass transit, people that ride, walk, or telecommute, or people that do car sharing. So there's those four categories. And there's a different carbon footprint associated with those four categories. So we look at what's called the mode split, because those are the four modes of transportation. So we look at what the split is for each building and then apply a carbon factor to that. So that's what we measure, and we'll get into it in a moment. But one of the things that we're really trying to push starting this year are electric vehicles, because it's a really great way to have an impact on the carbon footprint of transportation here.
And again, looking at energy, what has most contributed to success in this area?
In terms of what we've been doing within our group, probably the single biggest thing that we've done so far is we managed a program called Community Power Works for large commercial buildings for the city of Seattle. It was a grant-funded program that they had gotten from the U.S. Department of Energy. They had incentive dollars available, and we helped to manage the large commercial portion of it. And through that, we were able to seed 9 fairly significant retrofits in member buildings of ours, including some really prominent ones like the Pacific Science Center and the Washington Athletic Club, that made some pretty dramatic energy use reductions in those buildings. So I would think at least some of the success we're seeing in that area is due to those Community Power Works projects.
What have been some of the barriers to implementation?
Uncertainty in the economy. It's been a slow recovery, as many people know. And even as robust as things are here in Seattle right now, we are the fastest growing city in the country. It was a very difficult downturn for the real estate industry, and a lot of the commercial building owners in particular. They signed 5-year leases in 2009, 2010, 2011 that were still at pretty low levels, and that's still, for a lot of them, their income until those leases turn over. So there are some simple economic challenges. We do have some of the lowest energy rates in the country, and so there isn't the same level of financial incentive on making energy improvements in buildings as there are in, let's say, places like New York or Washington, D.C. or Hawaii. So those are also some challenges that building owners have.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Brian Geller, Executive Director of the Seattle 2030 District, a high-performance building district in downtown Seattle that aims to dramatically reduce environmental impacts of facility construction and operations. What is most associated with success? What have you learned about what works best in your work with a 2030 district?
What works best with us is really connecting with the building owners and managers, the people that really run the buildings, and understanding in some level of detail what their challenges really are, and then trying to match up or respond to those challenges with information about what's available in the marketplace. Because everyone's building and their organizational situation is to a large extent unique. So it is really important for us to understand what folks are up against and how we can really help them make sustainability matter and help them tie it to other things in their buildings, whether it's a higher level of service, whether it's better reliability for buildings. We have found, for example, we have a smart buildings program that we're doing with Microsoft and Accenture, where we're able to do something called continuous commissioning, which basically means monitoring every piece of equipment in a building to a much greater level of detail than is possible without continuous commissioning. It has really great energy savings and really great payback, but the main motivator for a lot of the people doing this program is that it also makes their buildings more reliable. They can spot problems, they can spot equipment failures before they actually happen. And for them, that's a big motivator. So making those connections is really where we've been able to see success.
What are some specific success stories with individual buildings?
So the Washington Athletic Club did a retrofit through Community Power Works, and they did a very innovative project where they did a lot of work in the building, and they're connected to Seattle Steam, which is a district energy system. And so what they were able to do is make the improvements on the building and then pay for the cost of the improvements through their steam bills without having to take any money out of their pocket. So they were able to do a 25% energy use reduction, and they didn't have to pay any money out of pocket. So they literally started saving money immediately without having to take any cash out of their capital budget. So we think that's a very successful project, and we hope that other people will follow that model. Another success story through Community Power Works was a major retrofit done at the Pacific Science Center. It's a facility that we all know and love, and they also, through Community Power Works, did a project that's going to save over 20% of their energy use. They are also going to see water use savings, and it's putting them on a very aggressive path that they have towards sustainability for the future.
What other U.S. cities have formed 2030 districts?
So a number of them have. That's probably one of the most exciting things that's happened since I was last on the show, is we've had other cities calling us up with interest in our model. Cleveland, Ohio, was the first one to reach out to us, followed closely by Pittsburgh, their nearby rival. Then we had Los Angeles and Denver. So there are five established districts with boards and members, and we've got, I think, about eight more that are in the what's called the emerging category, which means they have an exploratory committee, and they have between one and three building owners who have signed up to be part of the group. So Architecture 2030, which is the national organization I referenced before, they're actually coordinating and managing the expansion of this model into other cities and providing support for us all to speak to one another.
Would you say more about how well the 2030 districts are working in the other cities?
Sure. I think it's been varying degrees of success in the other cities. I think they certainly have generated a lot of excitement. Some of them have had more success with generating funding for their operations than others. But I think overall, it's been exciting to see this grow up as a grassroots effort, because most other projects like this have generally been something top-down, something from a very large organization or a government program. The 2030 District was a grassroots organization here in Seattle, and then it's become a grassroots organization in other cities. So I think that that excitement and those community roots are really important and successful. I think it is going to take some more time because of the length of the goals we have and because we're working with the real estate industry, with buildings. It's just an industry that doesn't move very quickly. It takes a long time to do projects. It will take some time for them to build up a track record, but overall, I think that they're doing quite well.
How does your work fit in with other efforts, such as the City of Seattle's District Energy Program?
We do consult with them, do chat with them quite a bit about these different projects, and make sure that our efforts, first of all, are not interfering with their efforts, but also that they are in sync with one another. We do share data where it's appropriate, do protect the privacy of our members, but we've put together some really great maps and great online tools where we can identify buildings that can connect to a district energy system versus ones that can't, where those are, how old they are, how big they are. So we do coordinate with the city as much as possible when they're looking at big projects like district energy.
Would you say a little more about what district energy actually is?
Sure. So district energy is where the heating and cooling of a building is actually provided remotely. It's not provided in the building. So in a typical building, you might have a boiler or an air conditioner or a cooling plant in the basement or on the roof or wherever. District energy system, and again, we have one, Seattle Steam is the largest one we have in the city. There's actually a large steam plant down on the waterfront, and that plant generates steam and sends it to 200 buildings in the downtown area and up on First Hill, and those buildings use that steam for heating, so they don't have their own boiler facilities. But that's the concept of district energy.
What is your relation to the city of Seattle as a whole?
We have a very close relationship with the city of Seattle. They were absolutely instrumental in forming our organization. We identified a source of funding from the EPA that we were not in a position to pursue on our own because we were just a voluntary committee with no legal entity. So the city actually agreed to essentially pursue the funding on our behalf, set the funding up in such a way that some of it went to the city for new construction programs related to our new construction goals, but that the rest of it went to set up an independent organization, which we did. And we've been able to identify other sources of funding and move on from that EPA grant. But the city remains a very important partner, a very active member. So we have a very close relationship with them.
You mentioned funding from the EPA. Where else does your funding come from?
So we've been able to secure grants from some local funders, from the Bullitt Foundation and from the Boeing's Foundation, from their corporate social responsibility arm. We have gotten some funding from the Kresge Foundation, which is a larger national foundation, and we were part of a winning grant from the U.S. Department of Energy for small commercial building work that was actually the first grant we pursued through the 2030 districts network. So there's actually four different 2030 districts that are all part of that grant, working with buildings that are 50,000 square feet and under. We have a number of sponsors. This year, 2014, was our first year for annual sponsors, and so a number of our members stepped up to sponsor the organization, and we are holding a fundraiser in October, on October 9th, at the Aquarium, where we hope to continue that trend.
What do you consider the greatest accomplishments of the Seattle 2030 District so far?
So far, I think the Community Power Works has been a great accomplishment. I think the work that we've done in the smart buildings arena, we have four buildings set up on Microsoft and Accenture's smart building service platform. We have over 20 buildings using Switch Automation's dashboard, which is another company that is active in the smart building space and provides a lot of dashboarding and automation and diagnostic services. We have a partnership with Nissan of North America that we're very proud of, where Nissan is donating electric vehicle charging stations to building owners, to up to 10 member buildings in the district. So we've done 2 electric vehicle charging station installations so far this year at 2200 Westlake and at West 8th. And we hope to do 8 more. We've got 3 more lined up. And we've also been doing a series of what we call ride and drive events, which is where we get a bunch of electric cars from all the different manufacturers together and let people drive them around. But we think that making inroads into that area has been a great accomplishment for us, because in the beginning, when we first started in 2011, we had a lot of tools for building energy, and we didn't really have a lot for water and transportation. We've really been able to expand on those water and transportation goal areas since then.
What are your plans for the future?
We really plan to start getting very aggressive about vehicle electrification, because when we look at the carbon footprint of the city, according to the city's 2008 greenhouse gas inventory, 59% of the greenhouse gas emissions in Seattle actually come from vehicles. Only about 30% come from buildings and building energy, building construction, because we have an electrical utility that is essentially carbon neutral. Seattle City Light, almost all of their power comes from hydroelectric dams and wind and solar. So this is probably the best place in the country to focus on vehicle electrification, to get people to power their vehicles with City Light's clean power instead of oil and gas.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Keep watching us. We're growing, and we are bringing more and more services into the arena that will hopefully be more and more relevant to people that are not just building owners and operators. The impact we want to have with stormwater, the impact we want to have around electric vehicles is something that will touch ordinary citizens, and we're very excited about that. So please keep an eye on our website and come to our public events.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Brian.
Thank you.
You are just listening to Brian Geller, Executive Director of the Seattle 2030 District. For more information, check on the web at 2030districts.org. Again, that's 2030districts.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.